Welcome to season 4 of the Coffee and Geography podcast. The aim of the show is to get to know, explore, and celebrate the diverse and intersectional range of people and their love for the world. Join your host, Kit Marie Rackley, and have fun exploring all the myriad of ways guests can connect their lives to geography. Today, let's listen to the human component of disasters, our common human identity, capturing essence of place and life in photos and other things. Got your brew ready? Great! Enjoy the listen.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Coffee and Geography. And I'm having the absolute pleasure for the second time now. It's almost like we're becoming friends, but we've got a long way to go yet. I'm joined by Elin Kelman. Hello. Good to see you again.
Hello, Kit. How are you doing? And thank you again for everything you're doing and the opportunity to be here.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, it's going really, really well. And folks, what I'll do, I'll put it in the show notes. We might reference something that we've done together already, which is something called the Reteach podcast, which Elin was very kind to give his time with his book, Disaster by Choice. And we might have a little bit of a chat about that. But we've covered that ground really, really well with the Reteach podcast. And also, we don't usually do hires and shout outs at the beginning of the podcast, usually do them at the end. But hi to Ellie Barker, to the Curious Geographer, because Elin, you had the pleasure of her company with her videos, her YouTube video.
And hello, Ellie. I mean, you've been doing fantastic work. So exciting. Yep. How much you support people and, of course, your students. And this is about geography. This is about teaching. So thank you, Ellie, for all the inspiration you give. And it certainly rubs off in the work I see Kit doing. So again,
Kit. I find her very, very inspirational. It's so wonderful that she's a colleague as well. So, so folks, in the show notes, I will put the links to both the video that Elin did with Ellie and the Reteach podcast episode that we did. But we might overlap a little bit. So Elin Kelman is Professor of Disasters and Health at University College London and a Professor Second at the University of Agder Kristiansand, Norway. And we might talk a little bit about Norway then. His overall research interest is linking disasters and health, integrating climate change into both. And the three main areas focusing on is disaster diplomacy and health diplomacy, island sustainability involving safe and healthy communities and isolated locations, and risk education for health and disasters. I'm wondering, Elin, have you been keeping a lot of attention on COP28? I have, with like a double face palm, as I do every year.
I think the double face palm, or maybe the quadruple face palm, maybe yes. The one to go for. I watch it, and I decided fairly early on in getting involved in these topics that I didn't think that going to these climate change meetings would be particularly productive. So I must admit that I've never been to a COP. I don't have a lot of intention of going to one, although who knows? And the answer is simply because when I got into this field, we are already so many COPs down the road, and they clearly were not being effective. We're thinking that they started in 1995. They haven't actually quite happened every year, but more or less. And this was number 28, which means it's not only some of the students are far younger than the COP process, it's some of the teachers are younger than the COP process. And it's such a distraction. Yes. It's such a circus, it's such an extravaganza. It's so compartmentalized in terms of its mandate and what it's meant to do. And despite the 28 meetings, it hasn't yet achieved its mandate.
And what irritates me, well, a lot of things irritate me about COP, but is this whole very, very artificial, at the end of every single one, the artificial pats on the back, smiling photo opportunities. Yes, haven't we done a good job? And like, you're just sitting there, folks like myself and you, and a lot of people listening to this podcast going, you are just completely detached from reality, all you folks just there.
So what you're saying,
given that we've done a good job.
What you're saying, Kit, is it's not just COP28, but it's number 28 of what a fantastic success we've had, and congratulations.
Yes, of course. Oh yeah, and Ed Hawkins don't have any more, doesn't need red anymore for his climate stripes, does he?
And so it's really disheartening to see how much time, energy, resources, effort is put in. People are so well-meaning. They are so dedicated, and they are really trying to help us all. And we know that the process itself is set up to be so fundamentally flawed, evidenced by the fact that it hasn't succeeded. And, you know, despite the fact, we are having a bit of a laugh about it, and it's easy to criticize it, which I think we ought to do, but it is very difficult seeing people put a whole year's effort into it every single year, and then come out of it with, as you say, the artificial backslapping and the lack of success. Yet we shouldn't be too despondent, because irrespective of COP, there's so much which is going to try and address climate change to stop it happening and work on its impacts. Yep. So it's not saying we're in a good space. Obviously, we're creating major problems for the world. We're changing the climate rapidly and substantively, and there's no doubt about that. But what I would like to see is a lot more emphasis, a lot more headlines, so much more highlighting the successes we have had and what people are doing to actually act, rather than, however well-meaning, doing their sort of world COP tour, coming to and at the end of every COP and an agreement which really offers little.
Yes, absolutely. Well, very well said. And people listen, you know, people, long-term listeners of this podcast, you know, wouldn't be nodding their heads listening to you there, Elin, because there's been plenty of examples of people I've spoken to on this very podcast where they've gone, yes, you know, there are some amazing folks there doing their thing, on all scales, you know, and very, very importantly, you know, the personal and local scale, which can make huge differences. And it actually, when you were saying that, Elin, there's two people in particular that was worth mentioning that I've spoken to in the past. And one was Rebecca Nestor, who's a climate psychologist, and she works for Norfolk and Waveney Mind up here in East Anglia. And, you know, and the amount of work that her and her colleagues are doing, you know, with regards to the mental health side of things, eco-anxiety, you know, reconnecting with nature and things like that, it's beautiful work that she's doing. And that kind of thing doesn't get talked about at all. And, you know, only briefly mentioned in things like the IPCC reports. And then you've got someone who's working on a bit of a wider scale, who I really admire. And that's, I think he's now a professor. That's Keston Perry, who's he's actually a political economist. But he works on decolonial efforts in terms of climate reparations and things like that, especially from the Caribbean. And when I interviewed him for the very first time, and he was telling about, you know, how climate change really started back in the empire building colonial days, and then and his work since is just, you know, so yes, I totally agree, folks. For all these people we see on the TV, you know, for show and all that kind of stuff, there is thousands of people like you out there, like Elin, like myself, my guests, who are doing what we need to do. So let's stay positive. So we started on but that was my bad going straight into the topic mentioning COP. So thanks for bringing that on a more positive note towards that, Elin. Right. Before I forget, you have a drink with you, a brew? A coffee, tea?
I have a glass of water. I tend to drink a lot of water, so when needed, ready to go with that.
Yeah, when we have such heavy hitting topics, perhaps just like keeping your palate moist is probably the best thing, to be honest. Unlike me, who gets jittered up on caffeine all the time. Awesome. So you're down there in London, so University College London, but you've mentioned Norway, obviously, and I know that you're very well traveled, because one thing I do want you to talk about a little bit as well is the kind of photographs you take when you go on your travels. So hold that thought for a second, because you might want to segue into it. But the question I always ask people, Elin, is when it comes to their identity, is kind of how has geography and the your lived experiences of the places you've been to, how have they formed Elin Kelman of today? So, you know, I have some influences of being in America for a bit. So, and, you know, I'm originally come from Essex. I've got Cockney parents, all that kind of stuff. And it's all formed my identity today. But what about yourself? So if you could like pin yourself geographically with your identity, what would that look like? What would the makeup be? I'm really intrigued, because you've been to a lot of places.
Well, I think that the standard response from people like us who have the privilege to really be trying to do better for the world, yes, and for humans is that our geographical identity is a planet. You know, the, yep, usual citizen of the world, citizen of planet Earth. And the travels have just been a privilege. It's about learning. It's about exchanging. It's about seeing and observing and also having people point out different perspectives, because just looking gives only one aspect of it, one dimension. Talking to people, listening to what they say, observing their reactions, having them describe myself also, opens minds. It opens pathways, it opens directions. And so that's where I very much say that, yeah, my identity is really sort of the fundamental basis of our species, being human, and recognizing that it is a wonderful, wonderful world out there. So many just amazing people with all their diversity, yes, all the variety, all their perspectives. And that's where I've been really fortunate to be able to live in the different places and travel, pick up ideas, learn different perspectives, not only through seeing, but also through listening, such as working on different languages, understanding words which do and do not exist across languages, across cultures, and different interpretations. And it really shows how ironically human we all are, and obviously should be, because that's what we are. So it makes sort of wondering why there is so much hate in the world. Yeah. Why do people say, yeah, over this tiny bit of land, I'm going to threaten absolute destruction and demoralize others and even force others to leave or to die? Why do we then look at other species and think they're there for our exploitation? Mm. Why do we create the wider structures and systems, which mean that people have no choice but to attack humans or other species? But ultimately, it's then saying, well, okay, things are in a bad way. There's not necessarily a lot of good that can come out of certain situations, but then it's up to us to try to do better. So how can we revel, absolutely, in the diversity and variety to improve? How can we recognize all the wonderful aspects that the environment gives us and that humans give us and that our interaction and intertwining give us? And what can we do to work together in order to improve ourselves in the world? And again, it really circles back to saying, well, what's my identity? Well, for good or bad, I'm a human being on Earth. And so how can we work with other human beings and other species on Earth in order to ensure that we are not hurting each other, but instead creating a much better future, which we all want and we all deserve?
Mm. And, you know, you would hope that that's a common identity for us all, really, fundamentally. You know, some people find that easier to access that part of our shared identity than others. I'm of a firm belief that everybody has the ability to grasp that. And as you know, we could talk forever, a whole new podcast about the factors that allow that to happen and the risk factors that prevent that from happening. But I really do strongly believe that, you know, fundamentally we all have that part in us and that we should be able to bond over that. So that's a very unique and lovely way of putting that.
Are you a business or organization passionate about ethical practices, products, and systems? Is being sustainable, inclusive, and equitable core to your values? And do you want to spread the word amongst listeners who share these ideals? Then sponsor the Coffee and Geography podcast. There are pricing options to suit a range of needs, and you know you are supporting independent educational efforts that aligns with your aims. Visit bit.ly/coffee. Geog, sponsor, for more details.
I'm going to, with regards to your travels and your photography, in particular, folks, I'll put the link into Elon's website with all these very interesting photographs that I'll put there. What I've done, Elon, is I've taken your photography list, which is, well, you've got on your website, is amazing. You've got all these locations, the times and the dates that you've been there. And, you know, you can click on all these kind of things and you can look at it by country and stuff like that. But underneath your country list, you've got your photographs by other themes, right? So what I've done is that I've put your other themes into a random topic generator, and so and then you'll come up with something, and then you've got to talk about it. Now, this is a little game that we play on this podcast called Jog On, where you can choose three of the five things to talk about. So you say jog on if you want to talk about it more, or take a hike if you want to skip it. But you can only use your skip twice. So I'm going to stick this through a random generator.
I am ready to go. This sounds exciting. Which also entails me remembering all the photos and themes which I've posted on the website.
Right. I actually have a spinner sound effect. So let's give this a play. Ooh. While I press the... Right. So we got here. Candles is the first one, Elon. So
jog on.
You want to jog on about candles, right?
Yes.
Talk to us about candles. And if you can remember any photographs you took with candles, that would be amazing.
There's always multiple levels. And obviously the candles are very artistic. Flames are fascinating to watch, preferably when they are under control rather than actually being an out of control fire.
Yes.
And yes, we use candles for ceremonies, for light, to indicate different aspects like shadows and spaces, and often simply for aesthetic purposes. So the artistry within different type of candles, and more to the point, their flames, is just something which really appeals in terms of working with lighting, working with shadow, working with movement, working with stilling, rapid movement, in order to generate this artistry. More to the core, or the scientific aspect of my work, when we're talking about being prepared for emergencies, one of the items on a list has to be some form of light. My preference is actually a wind-up torch or battery-operated torch, because not everyone has the ability to wind up. And certainly if someone goes for a battery-operated torch, have plenty of spare batteries. But often people will say candles. And yeah, they actually work very well, as long as obviously someone has matches or some form of lighting, or some form of way to light the candle. And interestingly, one of the UK ministers recently said that people need to be far more prepared in their own household and mention candles. So it's always this balance, because yeah, they are definitely on that list of items for an emergency kit. They are a fire hazard, and there are alternatives like the wind-up or battery-operated torch.
Mm.
So it's sort of that balance of thinking, we have this everyday object, which used to be absolutely essential. That's what people would use for lighting when we didn't have electricity. They are now used in many different ways today, but they are also a practical item. When we think about different religions or different households, some people actually just enjoy them. They turn off the lights, light some tea candles, and that creates ambiance.
We do that here.
We see them frequently, and several of my photos are actually from wonderful candles in restaurants. So yeah, they're part of our everyday society, used for many purposes, used to be essential, but they do have a very practical purpose, which people need to think about whether they want to use them as an emergency kit or look for non-fire prone approaches.
Amazing. You stole my thunder there, because I was actually going to go into about talking about emergency kits and stuff like that. Because one of the classic things, and all the geography teachers listening and students will know, oh, you remember that lesson we had to like prepare an emergency kit, like from in case there's something happens, I remember quite often actually like the debate around, should you really have a candle in there or not? You know, what if there's a gas leak or something like that? So, and I know I'm now coming into your realm because of your book Disaster by Choice, where you say disasters are human made, they're not natural and things like that. Yeah, and have lighting a candle where there's gas leaks around is a human disaster, that's for sure. So that was fascinating that you mentioned that. I'm going to spin the wheel again and see what comes up this time. Oh, okay. It's interesting. Tale of Toronto.
Okay, I'm happy to jog on with that. Absolutely.
All right, go for it. So who?
Now you've worked it out. You've looked at the photos.
I've seen it.
Do you want to describe what you see? What, who, why, where is Tale of Toronto?
Okay, this is... My heart has just really... Taya is a dog, an absolute gorgeous. So, I mean, are they a mutt? So yeah, must be a mutt, a crossbreed between two. Looks like a bit Alsatian in there. Maybe.
So yes, Taya is a dog, and one of my parents' dogs. The geographical aspect comes in being in Toronto, because that's where my parents are, and that's where Taya ended up having that life. And we don't quite know the combination of breeds which she was, so a complete mutt. My parents did do a DNA test, the doggy DNA test, and it came back with sort of just a bizarre combination, which some of it was absolutely clear within her behavior and her appearance, and some of it, really? So she was very athletic, as you can see some from the photos.
Yes.
Loved going after frisbees, loved going after balls, was an incredible runner. And because of our expectation that there was some border collie in there, the usual is if you're tired going out on a walk, but your dog, your border collie or border collie cross still needs exercise, just get two people, stand 100 meters apart and run back and forth forever. And that's absolutely what
this is true. This is so true. Yeah. When I made that big R is because of the last picture is Taya in a Halloween costume in 2012. That's just so cute. Oh, a little bat on the head. Oh, yeah. So, but I can
That means that you recognized her underneath that Halloween costume.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's because I've seen that face myself when I've, because I used to have dogs as well. We had two dogs, one after the other. Our first dog was a purebred German Shepherd who was not just our family pet, but was also my dad's police dog as well. Okay. And he was beloved by my dad, did quite a heroic figure in Essex Police, where he was a star of a comic. So one of my dad's colleagues was also a graphic artist. I did like one page A3 size comic strips of Terry and his dog, Ben, which was hilarious. They were absolutely hilarious. But also Ben and some other dogs were combined into a novel called Triton, which was like an amateur novel about service dogs. And that was really, really fun. So, and then when Ben passed away, he had to put him down. I think he was 14. Mm. He lived a really good life. And that's for a service purebred, that's actually really, really good. And he had taken bullets and knives from my dad and everything, but my dad was devastated when he had to be put down because his back legs just, he couldn't support him anymore.
Well,
and for Ben, that's effectively the end of his life, because of what the life he's led. And then we had a second, and then my dad, we got a second German Shepherd who didn't take to being trained very well by my dad, so we became more like that. And actually Taya reminds me very, very much of our second dog. He wasn't a pure Alsatian or German Shepherd. I think he had some muttiness in there, but because he looked more like Taya than a pure German Shepherd. So yeah, so when I saw these pictures of your parents' old dog, that definitely brought back memories to our second dog anyway. So,
and your second dog?
Ben as well, actually, because my dad was, you can imagine the emotional attachment that my parents and my family had to our first dog. And you can imagine that my dad was trying to recapture that in a second dog. But of course, dogs have got their own personalities, their own character and whatnot. So he was a completely different dog, but it was, he ended up being quote unquote my dog. You know, I was in my mid teens. I was the one who would take him out for walks and go play with him and stuff like that. And he was absolutely lovely dog. Yeah. Oh, I could spend all day looking at these pictures.
Anything on your website about a photo essay of Ben 1 from Essex or Ben 2 from Essex?
Oh, we're going to have to, yeah, we'll have to, gonna have to organize that. So, okay, I'll see if I can do it. No, Elon's put me on the spot now. Oh, okay, there are three fantastic pictures I will try and find. The first one is that they're all three of them of Ben the First, if you like, Ben Senior, where he's got a giant stick, which is, think of those comedy scenes with animals or YouTube videos of animals where the stick is so big that they can't go anywhere, like through a fence gap or through a doorway, and they keep getting stuck. This thing was huge. And he's standing there with this great big stick. This is wider than a window. And then you've got another one with me in a onesie. I was like I was just about standing, so I must have been cruising or just learning to walk. And I was in a onesie, like a snow onesie, and there's me standing next to Ben. And then the other one was a picture of Ben guarding my pram outside of a sweet shop, outside the newsagents. Because back in those days, in the 80s, leave little Kit in the pram outside while I go in the shop. Ben, stay. And every time some stranger would come up to the pram, my parents said, Ben used to go, you know, and then the person was like, well, okay, all right, I'll stay away from that pram. and then my mum or dad came out of the shop, and Ben had not moved a muscle next to that pram. He was very well trained, very well disciplined. But as soon as my dad took his uniform off, he was a lovely, fun-loving dog. But as soon as my dad put the uniform on, it was like a straight to attention, you know. It was ready to go to work.
Absolutely. So dogs know that. And Taya loves sticks too. But interesting, speaking of geography, here's a Taya geography story.
Oh, go for it.
In her later years, when she was just enjoying sort of the sunset of her life by sleeping and eating, which dogs do very well, she decided that she wasn't that enthralled by walks. Whereas in her earlier years, she would absolutely love them and go running and bounding. So when I would take her out, she would drag. And she wouldn't want to go out. It was almost as if she couldn't walk, as you're saying, Ben's hind legs started going. Yeah. As soon as I would turn around to go back to my parents' house, she would be out in front pulling me with amazing strength. And I tried, I experimented. I tried different routes. I tried turning 90 degrees or 180 degrees. She always knew when we were heading back to my parents' house, when we were heading back home. And so if I was trying to fool her, but she knew we were getting farther away, she would be dragging and would pretend not to be able to walk. As no matter what direction, as soon as I was heading back, she'd be out in front, all four legs going, dragging me. Geographical awareness in dogs.
I swear they have a sixth sense. So with our second dog, what happens that when my mum was at work and I'd come home from school early, you know, we was old enough to go home by ourselves, you know, raid the larder, get ourselves something to eat while waiting for mum or dad to get home, whatever. But at a certain time of the day, Ben Jr., we could call him, would go to the door and just sit there. And then 15 minutes later, my mum, who only worked 15 minutes walk away, my mum would walk through the door. And as she said, the same happened when I used to leave school. It's almost like Ben knew that I was coming home from school or my mum was coming home from work. So he would go and sit by the front door, you know, with his bum on the floor, hind legs on the floor, front legs up, wagging his tail, and he would just sit there. And you could hear, as you're coming down the road, him starting to bark.
My goodness.
You know? Yeah. And it's like, how does he know? So, and I'd never figure, I mean, perhaps we could find some research on this somewhere, but was it because he had a really good sense of time, maybe? Kind of, oh, this is about the time when Kit's going to get home, or about the time when Mary's going to get home, or was it more...
What happened when the clocks changed?
The same thing happened.
Well, so what's your second theory then? It can't be time because the clocks...
Yeah, maybe there was a bit of a lag, but as far as we could tell, there was... He'd do it all the time. So they seem to have this sixth sense somehow, but we don't know the workings of our own mind, let alone the workings of animal minds, do we? So, that was lovely. Well, you know, the only thing now, Elon, is that we've got three topics left, and we've only got one we can choose now. So you're gonna have to be selective, right? Spinning the wheel again, and then what are we gonna come up this time? Well, oh, that was lovely talking about Taya. Right, parliaments. You want to jog on or take a hike?
Parliaments, are you happy to jog on?
Yeah, well, go for it. Parliaments.
We want government. And quite right. And government is part of geography. When we're talking about history, when we're talking about places, when we're talking about centers and peripheries, the question is, what does parliament do for us? What do we do for parliament? And that completely varies. So even thinking back to candles, unfortunately, too much or so much is ceremonial.
And
completely pointless. When we think about the UK, so many new MPs come in and say, we seriously do that? Why? And the answer is, well, it's tradition. It's worked for 300 years. Why change now? We seem to forget that the Parliament encapsulates all these aspects, but surely Parliament should never lose its function in order to preserve form, which is a big challenge. And of course, many parliaments in the world are just there for show. They really don't have any powers whatsoever. So from a geographical perspective, looking at the buildings, there's the architectural aspects, there's the placement, there's the colors and the spaces in which they sit. But more to the point, from geography, is what they do for us, what we do for them, and the huge variety, even to the extent that in some countries, a head of state is the same as a head of government. In other countries like the UK, they're different. In some countries, the executive branch has to be chosen from elected parliamentarians. In some countries, it can be any appropriate citizen. So when we talk about these different branches of government, typically executive, legislative, and judicial, the intertwining and the separation, how they function, what they provide to us, is all a part of our society. And particularly, again, if we sort of even go back to COP28 or my specialty regarding disasters, it is life or death situations which are made in those buildings.
Mm.
Some of them are fairly mundane, some of them are spectacular. And even though we try and govern ourselves in these ways according to what we call countries or sovereign states, which then has this place called Parliament, the differences are just remarkable and really demonstrates how history, time, how place, space, and people, the three elements of geography, come together in terms of how we govern ourselves and how we don't have options to govern ourselves.
Yeah. And that actually brings me up, reminds me of the, was it a couple of months ago when the Australian Parliament decided not to recognise Aboriginal sovereignty, basically, within and give them a voice within Parliament. Which, I mean, I'll have to relook about the story, but there was something which the referendum, that was right. It was a referendum, wasn't it? And I just couldn't quite grasp, you know, why, you know, it was going back to what we were saying a bit earlier about how I strongly believe we all have universal values and commonality and things like that. But so for my brain and my world, it just does not compute why that referendum would fail, you know?
People had all sorts of reasons for voting against. Some of them said it didn't go too far.
Yeah.
And they wanted much more. What it seems is the majority of people who were against simply didn't want it to happen. And that comes from all sorts of motivations. Part of it is changing a governance structure, which can lead to drawbacks or unintended consequences. Part of it is pure racism. Part of it is just saying, I actually don't like the people who are proposing the referendum and I'm going to vote against it in order to spite them.
Yes. Yep. Yes.
But it's tough. That's and many common. Countries have had perhaps what we would consider, or certainly you and I definitely consider, appropriate steps forward, including everyone within a country, which of course we all should be included within our country, but it doesn't often happen. But then when we do look at the details and the legalities, there can be significant challenges. And when Canada repatriated its constitution from the UK, which was formally signed in the early 1980s, I think it was 1982, Quebec had a separatist government. And so Quebec was the one province that declined to be involved in this process, which meant that the Canadian constitution did not formally include Quebec. One prime minister from Quebec then started a process called the Meech Lake Accord after it was signed, in which would bring Quebec into the constitution. It had to go to a referendum with certain levels of voter support in order to pass, and it failed catastrophically.
Mm.
And part of that, again, it was the same issue in terms of it. Some people saying it doesn't go far enough, some people objecting to the process, some people objecting to the leaders, some just saying, Canada should be one country. Oh, sorry, Canada should be one language, one culture, and therefore don't want the others in. And it's all this whole combination. But a lot of that was also complete lack of faith, complete lack of trust in the leader pushing the treaty or the accord.
Yes. Yeah.
And in a sense, it's tough and it's frustrating, but it's understandable when I'm certainly not a lawyer. And I do read a lot of legal documents, and maybe I think I understand them, but whether I do, you know, or not is open to question. And then how are the courts going to interpret? How do the words of meaning, the meaning of words change and interpretations? And so some people said, we want Quebec part of Canada. We want Quebec within the Constitution fully, but I just do not trust what these particular leaders have done. And that is, you know, a sad commentary on our governance, but it is fully understandable.
Yeah. And then, so I guess circling back to what we said at the start about remaining positive and always having hope is that we can always treat these moments in history, if you like, towards progression or whatever, as not, well, they're, of course, they're setbacks, but they are stepping stones. You know, they are important stepping stones for lessons to be learned about. Oh, that stepping stone was a bit too slippery. Maybe we should try a different route. Or no, we had the right stepping stone. We just weren't trying to get onto it, you know, in an effective way. So that's the kind of way I like to approach when I do climate change education anyway, is that, yes, you know, I can say that COP28 was an abstract failure, but the stepping stone that I'm hanging on to with things like that is I was heartened by some of the officials who are like, this is just not acceptable, and calling it out and saying, we are not happy the fact that, for example, you know, the words phasing out fossil fuels is not in there. So yes, they were, you know, so, and I take heart from that kind of thing. And of course, we already discussed about the things that are happening from a bottom up, from a grassroots level up, you know, always gives me hope and stuff like that. And that is something that, because I always get a question when I do the, when I do my talks, my presentations and my performances, they say, Kit, how can you remain positive? How can you remain hopeful? Because you see the science, you see the data coming in year on year, month on month, which seems things are getting worse and worse and not getting better. We're not making progress. That the curve down to safe climate change is getting steeper and steeper and steeper because we're not starting yet. How can you stay hopeful? And I say, well, you know, you look at what is being done, the positives, the fact that there are plenty of people out there who are not never ever going to give up the fight. And then even the science says that when we do get a scruff of the neck of this thing, you know, we're always going to have the potential of getting to a stable climate where we can start rebuilding, you know, our society, reaching a new norm, you know, becoming adaptable, and then we can work on those inequalities. So it's always, there's always something to play for. We might miss one boat, we might fall over one hurdle, but we can get up again and get back to that finish line. So, and that's the only way, that's how I keep going, Elon, you know.
And this process about Quebec in or out of the Canadian Constitution is fascinating in that regard, because there have been the different efforts, and it was about provincial parliaments supporting it, and then referenda in order to see how to do it the best. One of the efforts failed because there was an Indigenous parliamentarian who felt that the agreement reached did not adequately account for Indigenous rights. So it's all these balances. And people actually standing up for themselves and saying exactly as you're aiming for, well, how do we do better? How do we come together? Sometimes it means a good effort and a well-meaning effort, like the COP process, for example. Mm-hmm. Maybe it should not succeed in the way expected. Yes, because if there is an agreement which ticks the boxes, it may not be the agreement that we need, not just for human-caused climate change, but for wider sustainability. Maybe it's not the agreement that we need, not only to bring Quebec into the Canadian Constitution, but as with Australia, ensuring that Indigenous peoples across Canada are fully integrated into society. And some people will say, hold out for everything, don't compromise. Others will say it's incremental, step by step.
Yep.
Another example is use the phrase going for a stable climate, but we've never had a stable climate. And so what we want is actually a climate in which is varying naturally, where we're not changing it as much as we are doing, in order to accept that we are part of the planet, we need to live with it, and therefore it's living with nature. And that includes weather variability, climate variability, but ensuring that when these changes do happen naturally, they don't adversely affect us, but we're able to adjust, we're able to survive and deal with it.
Absolutely.
And more than survive, thrive.
Yep, Yeah, and that's a really good point that you make. So when I do these public engagements, for simplicity, I condense it to a stable climate. But of course, what I mean by that is a stable climate on a human timescale, because climate is not stable and it shouldn't be stable. With regards to on a bigger timescale, you know, thousands to tens to hundreds of thousands of years, it should be naturally varying. So you've made an excellent point there. Right, we went off on an amazing, fantastic, interesting tangent there. I'm going to spin the wheel twice more just to say, here's what you could have talked about, kind of thing. Yeah, so I'll forego the sound this time. So that it would have been dice, and okay. The other one would have been, waiting for it to do, insects. So there you go. They're the two you've by default taken a hike on. But people can have a look at their website and have a look at those pictures, not just of dice and of insects, but lots of stuff on there. Do take it out. And I just love your insights on those things. And folks, do check out Elon's website on that respect. Okay. Whoa, 40 minutes in already. Wow. Time does fly when you're having a lot of intellectual fun.
Hey, educators. If you teach any geography, environmental or human or physical science-based topics, then check out Kit Marie Rackley's website at geogramblings.com. There you will find musings, blogs, resources, analyses, and more. Perhaps you want to brush up, learn, or dig deeper into a geographical issue? Or you're looking for a resource you can use in the classroom? Or maybe looking for someone with an award-winning, diverse expertise and skill set to collaborate with you on a project? Kit Marie offers free 30-minute friendly consultations if you're looking to brainstorm ideas. Jog on to geogramblings.com to explore and find out more.
So what should we think about next? Yeah, okay, let's cover your work slightly then. We've kind of talked about you know, bits and bobs kind of like by proxy and at a tangent as well. But and of course, I'll say again, folks, if you want to listen to Elon give some really fantastic, amazing points to think about, do listen to the Reteach podcast episode and to Ellie Curious Geographer's chat with Elon. But what I really find fascinating with your work, is this whole thing that about disasters have this massive human element to them, and we're habituated, especially us geography teachers. And I made the slip up in the Reteach podcast, actually, didn't I? Even though I'm aware of all this myself and I've read your book and everything, but even I once, didn't I, made that Freudian slip of saying natural disaster, if you remember, because we're so used to that term. And even though, despite all of my knowledge, I still slipped onto that. So your work at the moment of what you're doing about trying to say, this is, you know, the world works in this natural ways. We have these natural processes, but it's humans. It's our interaction with these natural processes, which really is the things we've really got to be studying. We've really got to understand and we've really got to grasp. So tell us a little bit about your work in that respect.
This is part of the positive aspect. Not only can we stop disasters happening, but of course we should. We actually have all the knowledge, resources, abilities that we need. It's just people who have the political power, who have the opportunities, who have the resources, are making other decisions. So what can we do together? Well, it's about when we're in places like the UK, where we can hold our leaders to account to some extent, it's telling them what we can and should be doing, to recognize that a lot of houses in the UK are still being built in floodplains, that a lot of coastal communities are not ready for tsunamis, to finally take pandemic lessons from this absolutely awful inquiry that's going on in COVID-19 at the moment and apply them. Because the previous coronavirus pandemic from 2002 to 2004, which was SARS, there was a draft House of Lords report saying what we need to do in order to deal with the pandemic. And as far as I can tell, it remained draft because SARS disappeared, so why worry?
Yep.
And just a few years before COVID-19 emerged, the NHS held a huge 3-day exercise with almost 1,000 staff.
Yeah, about, I remember that.
With a flu pandemic.
Yeah.
And the result was, you know what? The UK isn't ready to deal with the pandemic, so let's not worry and let's not do anything. I mean, it's absolute madness. We had all the knowledge we needed. Even if we go out to other countries, people will talk about, well, low-resource countries or poor countries or low-income countries. I've yet to see a poor country. I don't see any low-resource or low-income countries. All of them have, well, first of all, human beings, and they're amazing, amazing human beings. Yeah. But also, there's always money. There's always resources. There's always richness. It's just that some countries are better at corruption and pilfering off the richness than other countries. And so some countries are better at hurting their own people than other countries. So, yes, I mean, it's always this balance of, yeah, there is corruption. There is awfulness. There is hate. There is that desire to hurt others. There is looking at certain groups and saying, well, they don't deserve to live, or who cares what happens to them. But the other side is the disasters which we have avoided. And I do have one project which is partly supported by the US space agency, NASA, and two colleagues, Gareth Byatt and Anna Predos. We've actually created a website, disastersavoided.com, to list examples
of
action was taken so disasters did not happen, and trying to collate it into a 6-point understanding of what are common patterns and what do we need in order to make it more general and say, this is how we avoid disasters. And the examples come from the so-called poor countries and the so-called rich countries. So even Bangladesh, which has had horrific, horrific cyclone catastrophes, killing over 100,000 people on multiple occasions. In the past 5 years, a handful of similar cyclones have ripped through the country, and the death toll has been dozens. Now, dozens isn't good. The disruption isn't good, but it's a lot better than 143,000 in 1991 and over 300,000 dead in 1970. So it shows that irrespective of calling them poor or developing or low-resource countries, they actually can avoid disasters. This doesn't stop Dhaka being horribly vulnerable to earthquakes.
And
when that earthquake does hit Bangladesh, it could be the first million death earthquake recorded in human history. But what it shows is, again, that's disaster by choice. Because if Bangladesh can deal with cyclones, Bangladesh can deal with earthquakes. They've made the choice to deal with cyclones. They've made the choice to not deal with earthquakes. And conversely, of course, we take our supposedly rich, powerful world power country, which kit would be which one?
Well, you know, depends on what metric you're going on, but I suppose, but you know, things like the United States would be obviously on the top of people's minds.
Absolutely. The United States of America. And yet it had Hurricane Katrina in 2005.
Yes.
It hurt a nation, and understandably, it devastated a city, and it was all preventable. From the fact that Hurricane Betsy, Hurricane Camille went through in the 1960s, so they knew that they were in a hurricane zone. And of course, you know, when you're in Hurricane Alley and it's hurricane season, you should expect a hurricane. To the people that the mayor of New Orleans at the time ended up in prison on felonies. And the person in charge of the U.S. Emergency Management Agency at the time, what basically had no prior experience of dealing with disasters, yet he was appointed to keep a country safe. So when, again, as you say, well, we tend to think of the U.S. as being powerful and rich and the world power, it is absolutely still susceptible to these forms of catastrophe. And again, despite its richness and resources, it deliberately creates racial inequity. It deliberately creates marginalization and oppression. It deliberately has money which is being collated with a small number of people who basically collect it and deprive others. So any country can avoid catastrophe if they want to, and any country can create catastrophe if they want to. We need to stop this artificial division according to alleged income or apparent resources.
Yeah, and this folks, this is something we can go on another 40-50 minutes. It's but this is just a small insight into what Elon's work is and a lot of people's work in. So I can't recommend your book enough, Elon. And thank you. Well, I don't know where I should be. Thank you for letting me know about this website, because now I'm going to be spending a fair bit of the afternoon having a look for it. But it's definitely worth looking at. And all I will say, and I'm not going to give it too much away because I want people to go and have a look themselves, but nice one on the choice of map. That's all I'll say.
Thank you.
Nice one on the choice of map.
Yeah, that's disastersavoided.com. And again, this is geography because the US, which has a lot of recent experience on West Coast earthquakes, we hope that things are reasonable to some degree there, partly because a lot of vulnerable infrastructure would have collapsed in previous earthquakes, partly because they're aware of the hazard. The East Coast is trying, but they're certainly simply not at that level. And so even within the US, we would actually potentially expect more casualties in an East Coast major earthquake than in a West Coast one. A lot will depend on the time of day. A lot will depend on where people are. A lot will depend on how well building codes have been enforced. But again, any rich country, rich or poor, or allegedly rich or poor, can do anything they want regarding hazards or simply not worry about them.
Absolutely. Brilliant. Right. So unfortunately, we are coming towards the end of our wonderful, wonderful chat. You are certainly, as most of my guests, and there's certainly someone I can speak to for all day if we had the chance. We're going to finish off with the tradition of We Are All Geographers, which is where we link all of our guests together, where we do like a bit of a word chain, really. So for those of you of the older generation, think Bob Monkhouse, if you like. And the comedian. So what this is that Elon's going to be given a word by our previous guest, which Elon can talk about for 30 seconds maximum, and then Elon will come up with a word for our next guest to talk about for 30 seconds. So last week's episode, folks, you remember listening to the wonderful James Riding, and or James Riding a Bike, as we because I needed to know how to pronounce his last name. And he did the first clever thing where he actually came up with your word, Elon, during his 30 seconds for his word. He was given the word butterfly, and then right at the buzzer he said DNA. So DNA is what he would like you to speak to for 30 seconds. So I've got my timer ready, my 30 second timer. So are you ready to talk about DNA in any way, shape or form you so wish?
I'm ready to talk about DNA.
Okay. All right, then, Elon Kelman on DNA, folks, for 30 seconds. Here we go.
So I'm going to take DNA to be designated national authority, which is within the climate change COP process. And so in theory, countries are meant to designate an authority in order to deal with these wider climate change processes. And it's particularly with respect to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the UNFCCCC, which is now just called UN Climate Change. So it really is about looking at emissions. And was that the buzzer?
That was a buzzer.
Oh, okay. I barely got started. Do we have 30 minutes before the buzzer?
I know. This is just how wonderful this chat has been. Everything could be 10 times longer. Oh, but I love the switcheroo you did there. But because we've left it on a bit of a cliffhanger, that this is going to cause people to go and look at what that DNA is now. So
delighted if they do that. This is all about finding information for oneself.
This is amazing. So last week we had a first where the word came within the 30 seconds, and this week we've had a first where we've deliberately cut it short and people have got to find out for themselves. I love it.
Yes.
But you get the pleasure and the joy now of coming up with something for our next guest.
Well, the challenge is to link it to geography. And so I was thinking of something, perhaps a body part like duogenum or jejunum, but then I realized that that's easy. That's a geography of the body. So instead, I'm going to go with an action of the body. And the word is rictus, R-I-C-T-U-S, which is about
R-I-C-T-U-S.
R-I-C-T-U-S, rictus, which is sort of about gaping or opening of one's mouth.
Oh, which I've been doing quite a lot this chat. I've been doing a lot of rictus.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So place your bets, folks. Is my next guest going to say, what is that? I bet they are.
Well, that could take 30 seconds.
Absolutely. Yeah, the rictus itself might be the 30 seconds, right?
Yes.
Oh, brilliant. Okay, so Elin, to finish off then, a couple of things. Any shout-outs you would like to give to anybody and for people to connect with you, because I know you're on social media, how can people...
Well, absolutely repeat again to Ellie Barker and, of course, yourself, Kit, but a lot of it is the geography teachers. I mean, I've been so privileged that actually a lot have invited me around England to give talks and try and encourage and support their students, and it's not easy. With resource constraints, with worsening ratios of teachers to students, and also with the aspect that some of the students, of course, had a lot of lockdown education and are often glued to TikTok with that attention span, it is not easy. So in a sense, it's a shout out to all geography teachers, all teachers, for what you are doing in order to support our society, a shout out to all students for what they have gone through in society, nothing of their own making. And a shout out also to carers and parents for balancing these challenges. Education is about our society. It's about the next generations. And it's not been easy because of the people with power creating the disasters, which we ought to have stopped. So really, thank you to all of you.
Yeah. And where can folks find you? Because they definitely should be following you, because you've got some really interesting takes, I think, on social media and whatnot.
Well, very kind. So I'm still on X for the moment. I'm also on Mastodon and Instagram and Threads, and that's just my name, at Elan Kelman. I'm also on Facebook, so you're welcome to search for my name and connect there, although I'm actually approaching the maximum number of friends, so I don't know if I'm still but LinkedIn is another one. And for researchers, academia.edu and ResearchGate. But ultimately, you know, old technology, drop me an email.
Yeah,
and if it doesn't disappear, as emails occasionally do, not too frequently, then always happy to be in touch to learn.
Yeah.
But whatever works, whether it's direct messaging through social media, whether it's email, or you can find my work phone number online, feel free to pick up the phone. And if I'm around, I will definitely answer it, because this is about exchange. This is about learning.
Yeah. And one thing I've come to realize about yourself is that you're very, very generous with your time and connecting with other people. And we can I say on behalf of the education community and geography teacher community, thank you on their behalf as well for being so kind and generous and just such a really interesting person as well. And it's just been an absolute privilege getting to know you. It really has.
Very kind. And definitely, as you sort of said earlier, if you go to my website, elankelman.org, and look at the photos and the themes, let me know if there's a particular theme or challenge you think I might have photos with, which I should add. There is everyone's challenge. Give me a theme for photography.
Right, folks, do it. So tag in Elan or message us here at Coffee and Geography, and then we'll get you to have a special coffee geography challenge, photography challenge for you. Get it up there on your website. That's amazing. Oh, brilliant. Oh, thank you so much for your time, and it's been wonderful spending the afternoon with you.
And thanks to you, Kit.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope you had fun. If you haven't already done so, please subscribe to the podcast and give us a rave review. Make sure you share and rate each episode, as every time you do this, it helps more people find us and continues the conversation. If you fancy being a guest or have any feedback, follow us on Twitter at @coffeegeogpod and send us a DM. Or you can email us at coffeegeogpod@geogramlings.com. Until next time, keep jogging.